On digital,
on the ABC Listener,
online
and on air,
the Tasmanian Country Hour with Meg Ferguson and Larissa Smith. On 936 ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Well, it's the Country Hour's 80th birthday this week, and we're on the road to celebrate the longest continuously running radio program in Australia. And we feel pretty lucky to tell these rural stories every day. And today, you're going to hear a bunch more from Elizabethtown in the Meander Valley, halfway between Launceston and Devonport on the Bass Highway, a region known for its dairy, berries and beef, among other things. Over the next hour, we'll find out how they've been performing this season.
Now, I've lost Anne, but that's okay. She's here. Today we are broadcasting from a family-owned dairy and cheese producer, a little place called Ashgrove. You may have heard of it. For more than 100 years, the Bennetts have farmed here at Elizabethtown and are central to the story of this region. And in the spirit of old-school farm hospitality, they're hosting us today. Thank you very much. And they've even brought some homemade scones. Anne.
Well, thanks so much for coming to Elizabethtown today, because a lot of people usually drive through it. And there's a lot of businesses here, of course, that have put Elizabethtown on the map. But we couldn't start today without traditional scones with Ashgrove cream and some jam, because it really represents the Bennett family for the generation. So I remember the milk coming in the warm pails, and my mum and my aunt would chill it down, and then the pryers would be scooping off the thick cream. And that's, you know, how we start our business. So it's also hospitality for the Rural Hour. I'm sure that you've been presented hundreds and hundreds of scones. And I hadn't really heard during the celebrations whether anyone had greeted you with a plate. So on behalf of, you know, welcome, and on behalf of the founders that are here today that are going to tell their stories and connect in with the radio, just welcome and happy scones.
Thank you so much. I do look forward to digging into them, but I didn't really think about how I'm going to talk and eat scones. So, Larry, I'm going to give those to you.
Thank you, Meg.
And we'll eat them, and maybe their founders can eat them. Well, speaking of the Bennett family, I'm going to take a seat in front of three very important guests. In front of me, we've got Connie Bennett, Michael Bennett, and Maureen Bennett. Maureen, Connie, Michael, yes, I think I've got that in the right order. Connie, I'm going to start with you. Your late husband, John Bennett, was ABC Rural Legend of the Year in 2017. He was recognised for his lifetime contribution to the Australian dairy industry. Connie, how important was the ABC Rural Hour for John, particularly during his time as president of the Australian Dairy Farmers Federation?
It was vitally important because it was an era where there was no mobile phone, no internet, and the ABC rural reporting was fundamental to information crossing Australia and reaching every farmer, and especially the dairy farmers. It was magnificent, and thank you.
Thank you. And you were a listener yourself, I believe.
Pardon?
And you were a listener yourself, I believe.
I am an avid listener of the ABC Rural Report. I am celebrating this year my 85th year. I'm 5 years older than the report, and I've been listening since I was five, or whenever it started, with the kitchen wireless at home in Ulverston with Mum and Dad, and they were great Blue Hill supporters. But we were Blue Hill supporters, but ever since, I have watched and listened and supported the Rural Report, entertained a few reporters, and I listen now in my aged years. Every morning at 6:30, I'm listening to what's happening on the ABC and to the Agricultural Hour, and then again at lunchtime, and I happen to hear often 4 or 5 o'clock the national ABC Rural Report. So I keep up to date with what is happening, and you are so important, and I support every word that you say, whether I support it physically, that's another thing, but it's so important to have that communication across this nation, and it's so good for the community to be connected, city and country, and the producers, and it makes Australia great.
Connie, your proud, kind words are making me blush. Thank you very much. Really appreciate that. Now, Michael, sitting right in front of me here, Ashgrove co-founder, born in Elizabethtown. You've witnessed decades of change in the community. You've relied on ABC Rural for weather, markets, farming insights, I'm sure. How has ABC Rural supported you throughout your farming career?
Well, happy birthday to ABC. The 80th is a very important milestone. I haven't had to face that yet. I tell my grandkids that I am 70, 17.
Right, so you've been 70 for 17 years.
But the ABC has been very important, and it's just as important as when it was founded, because when I first started listening to it in the 1950s, 1940s, there were big changes going on in agriculture there, just as big as there are now. And it was post-World War II. The emphasis was on food production worldwide because there was a fear that the world wouldn't be able to feed itself. A lot of countries had been hungry through World War II. And fortunately, that has never eventuated. And it was also prophesied that we couldn't feed the world's rising population at that time. And yet, before the year 2000, but then when we reached the year 2000, we were producing more food than ever. We still are, and there's plenty of food in the world to feed the world's population, which the ABC has played a very important part in Australia in disseminating knowledge. Now, the knowledge that was required when I started was different, and one of the things was that there was a lot of agricultural land just being developed at that stage, with heavy machinery and everything, and a lot of that was poorer country that the earlier settlers had discarded because it wasn't, they thought the land was no good. And yet when it was cleared, and if it had fertiliser and trace elements, it had a pivotal role in changing the whole attitude towards some of those soils. And we had the agriculture department then, which regionally were much stronger. For example, here our local base was Deloraine, where there were about 12 to 14 permanently working there in the department. That has disappeared years ago. And a lot of that work is done now by private consultants. The work agriculture department is still doing is still just as important as ever, but more experimental. But throughout that, the ABC has been pivotal in disseminating that knowledge, just as the knowledge that's coming out now in robotics and with AI and all these things that we want to need, we have to disseminate it. And the other role that's important for the ABC that is overlooked, I think, is there are still a lot of people watch. I'm particularly thinking of your landline. Is very important to rural Australia because we have, in one aspect, I think there are two classes of people in Australia now, those who live in the cities and those who live in the country. And a lot of the city people are extremely ignorant of what happens in the country, but it is surprising when you dig down a bit how many people in the cities actually listen to some of the rural programs, and it's their only method of keeping contact with the country.
Fantastic way to connect, isn't it? Now, I would love to ask you, we're sitting here at Ashgrove, this is the Tasmanian Country Hour, doing a live broadcast from Ashgrove Cheese. When you started this partnership many, many years ago, could you have envisioned what we're sitting in now, which is quite a fancy building, really?
Well, you always hope for what you're going to achieve. We did a budget originally, and we achieved what we thought was possible. But I think in modern farming, or I suppose in any sort of business, some of the things you don't plan on, but you've also got to see opportunities as you go. And what is important is to be able to take them up quickly if those things do occur.
We better go to your wife before we run out of time, before the weather. Maureen Bennett, welcome to the Country Hour. Thanks for coming.
Thank you, Meg.
Maureen, you are also a co-founder. You're a former ABC Rural Youth Award recipient and a bit of a local historian. I want to start quickly with your memories of Elizabethtown. What do you know? Where did it come from?
Well, I came here almost 60 years ago, not quite. And, of course, the Elizabethtown of that time wasn't even the Elizabethtown of Michael's time when he was a child. I remember Michael's grandmother telling me, when she sat in a room which was on this site here, just where we are now, saying that when she came here in 1908, the roads were so rutted that cars could barely use them, and there was hardly a car went past the door. And now, of course, but when we came here, we lived, moved into our house, and the roads were very bad. When the bus, school bus was going along the road, he complained that his mirrors were being hit by the trucks as they went past. And that was the Bass Highway. And it was so narrow that, you know, two large vehicles could barely pass each other, especially on a corner. And so, yes, things changed a lot in the 1970s when they improved the road, and the roads have got more and more busy every year. As far as farming goes, the farms were still in fairly small farms. They were fairly small at the time. Now it's been amalgamated, and we own a fair bit of what is called Elizabethtown, or between the various members of the family. And so that's one of the biggest changes, that no longer are there lots of families with children going to school. There's just the farm workers live in those houses now, and they may have children, but not a lot of them do. So things like that have changed a lot.
Now, I better get you to quickly say, before we go to the weather, I'd just love to know where the name Elizabethtown came from, I believe, connected to the Queen.
Well, as far as I know, there was no Queen Elizabeth in 1826.
That's a fair point, yes.
It's lost in the mists of time. Nobody really knows. The first Elizabethtown was New Norfolk. And that was called Elizabethtown before they changed the name to New Norfolk. And then in 1840, the only part of it that was Elizabethtown was over on the hill on that side of the Rubicon. And that was marked out in streets. But no one went to live up on the hill. The Elizabethtown grew up along the road, and all the facilities that they did have, like the pub and the post office, the school, and even further along near Forest Hall was a blacksmith shop. They were all along the road, and only two or three houses up on the hill. So it's interesting that after 1970, a lot of houses and the town developed, and this became part of Elizabethtown. Before that, it was just known by the property name, which originally was Whitefoot Hills.
There you go. A mystery. We'll have to get someone. I'm sure one of our listeners might even be able to fill us in with even more. Thank you. We've got to get to the weather now, but thank you very much for joining me, Michael, Connie and Maureen Bennett. Thank you. Over to you, Larissa. If you can find your microphone.
Yes, we have Ursula Connor at the Weather Bureau. Hi, Ursula.
Good afternoon, Larissa.
What's happening with the outlook for the rest of Thursday?
Yeah, well, we've currently got a cold front approaching the state at the moment, so that's bringing fairly strong and gusty northwesterly winds over the state at the moment. There is a severe weather warning out for large parts of the Central Plateau, East Coast, and even parts of the southeast now over the Hobart area as well. We have seen damaging wind gusts of 102 kilometres per hour through Hobart, and then as well up on Mount Wellington and Hart's Peak, but certainly some other strong wind gusts through most of the state as well. So a little bit windy around today. We do have some warmer temperatures as well. So a few regions through the west, central and eastern parts picking up high fire dangers today as well. Not too much in the way of rainfall coming through with this front. A few light showers mainly pushing into the west and the north of the state, but they are moving quite fast with these strong winds, so nothing picked up in the gauges as of yet today. Those winds will start to shift westerly as the front makes its way across the state and start to ease below those warning thresholds into this evening. We'll then have a ridge of high pressure moving in behind that, and that will start to clear up the showers and settle down the winds tomorrow. Won't be quite as warm tomorrow, but still a fine day ahead for our Friday, Larissa.
Okay, lovely. Coastal waters and swell today.
Yeah, at the moment, obviously a bit windy out there. We do have those northwesterly winds around 20 to 30 knots across most of the state. A little bit less in the northwest, more like 15 to 25, but then a bit stronger through the south at around 25 to 35 knots. As I said, they will be shifting westerly from the west this evening, more like 15 to 25 knots, but still a little bit stronger around 35 knots in the south. We'll continue to see that easing trend into tomorrow morning as that ridge pushes in. So we're largely looking at variable winds below 10 knots about the north and the eastern coastal waters, but they'll be remaining around 15 to 25 knots out of the northwest around about the west and the south. In terms of the swells, in the west and south, we're looking at a southwesterly swell of 2.5 to 3.5 metres. That will be building to around 4 metres as we go into tomorrow morning. In the north, we're largely looking at a westerly swell below 1 metre. And in the east, a couple of swells there, a southwesterly sort of below 1 metre and also a northeasterly below 1 metre as well.
What have we got in the way of warnings?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, we have that severe weather warning out for the Central Plateau, parts of the southeast and east coast for those damaging wind gusts for today. We also have a strong wind warning for all coastal waters except for the far northwest, and that increases to a gale wind warning through the southern coastal waters from Tasman Island to Low Rocky Point. And that strong wind warning also extends through all of the southeast inshore waters and the inland lakes for today.
Oh, thank you so much. Thanks, Ursula.
Thanks, ladies. Bye.
It's 22 past 12.
ABC Sport. Jack Jumpers basketball returns to ABC Sport. Join myself, Chris Rowbottom, and the best NBL experts in Tasmania for selected home game calls. JJ's Basketball on ABC Radio Hobart. In your suburb, in your town, this is Larissa Smith and Meg Ferguson and the Country Hour. On 936 ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
We're broadcasting from Ashgrove at Elizabethtown in the state's north. Meg's just tucked into a beautiful scone with jam and cream.
Yeah, it was really good. It's very warm in here, I have to say. This cream is melting on the scones, so you better get one, Larry.
We are here celebrating the Country Hour's 80th birthday all week. We are milking it for all we can because we do love what we do. Well, it definitely doesn't feel like the first week of summer. So many crops are behind due to the weather, and this has created all kinds of headaches for berry growers in particular, with a huge overseas workforce that have arrived in Tassie. One of those growers dealing with this conundrum is Steph Terry from Tasmanian Berries. Hello, Steph.
Hello, and happy birthday to the Country Hour.
Tell me about this season. How has it started?
It's definitely a bit slow. We are looking like we're probably 2 to 3 weeks behind where we were in the last few seasons. And so what that means for us is we're about 60% down on our main production of strawberries and blackberries at this point in time. We've probably harvested about 48 to 50 tonne of strawberries, whereas this time last year we were in excess of 110 tonnes of strawberries. So for labour forecasting, that's created a few issues. We've currently got about 300 seasonal workers on farm in Tasmania, so working across our sites in central northern Tassie. We are due to have another 130 come in by Christmas and a few more in the new year. So about a 460 worker workforce coming in, but unfortunately we are bringing forward jobs that we would normally be just scattering through the season, like weeding, tunnel maintenance, just general farm repair and maintenance. So everything is looking very tidy and beautiful, but it doesn't pay the bills.
Because under the PALM scheme, you have to ensure that you do have work for the people that are here.
Yeah, there's very strict requirements, and part of their visa conditions are they are required to have a minimum of 30 hours per week work. It can be averaged over a four-week period, but in saying that, there are also requirements per week or per pay period that we have to still make sure that they're given enough money to live and get by in addition to their expenses. So it does become a very costly time of year, and we have made financial decisions in the last few weeks to postpone some of the recruitments coming in that should have been here by now, but we ended up having to push them back. So they'll come in on about the 16th of December, and by then we're really hoping that the crop has taken off.
And the sun has turned up and the summer's arrived.
That would be handy.
And I guess you're not alone. A lot of the growers around the state would be in a similar position.
Yes, everyone's delayed start to the season has created some problems. There's excess labour on in all the horticultural businesses. We're just really hoping that the sun comes out soon, because our businesses thrive on growing degree hours. The tunnel infrastructure helps that. The longer days help that. But certainly a little bit of heat would help the crops start to ripen and just bring on the production. The fruit's there, but it's not ripening.
And I suppose you would have contracts in place with your buyers too. Supermarkets would be expecting that fruit.
In past years, they have had a lot more, so they forecast based on previous production. They are really good to work with, Driscoll's, who we grow for, with the marketing team, and understanding that it is, you know, a force of nature. We can't predict how it will go. And obviously the Eastern Seaboard is all affected at the moment. So we just have to work with our marketers to make sure that the forecasting is as accurate as possible. So hopefully in the new year and going into later January, February, our consumers are still very much motivated to buy seasonal produce, Tasmanian grown produce, and that they get on board buying berries.
So what does that mean for prices then, if the fruit is coming in dribs and drabs and it's not just Tasmania?
We had a really bad year a couple of years ago in 2003. It really crashed the price. It made things unpredictable, and it just creates uncertainty. So if there's a huge glut of fruit, the price drops. If there's not as much around, it goes up, but then you're competing with other commodities as well. So at the moment, I've noticed there's a lot of mangoes in the shops, that it changes the pricing. So it's really up to the marketers to push the berry production and all of the different varieties of berries that we supply the supermarkets, to have that there as much as possible to maintain it in the market, and make sure that people are seeing that product there so that they can repeat buy.
Can you give us a sense of the scale of your business now here and in Queensland?
Sure. So we're working with about 90 hectares of protected cropping. So most of our berries are grown hydroponically, either in sort of coir bags or tabletop infrastructure, or in pots under tunnels or within a big enclosed hothouse. So that allows us to have better growing conditions for the fruit, protects it and keeps it contained in that area. We also have blueberries, which are not undercover, and they're also grown in the ground. So try to mitigate risk by having different sites, and obviously growing in Queensland gives us off season production from the Tasmanian season. So we try and have year-round production, so as a business we can have year-round income and pay workers, give more opportunities to people to work for longer periods on their visas. We sort of supply in our peak season in Tassie about 4 shipping containers worth of fruit across Bass Strait every day.
That's a big volume.
Yes, yeah. So we're trying to work back up to that because it's not there at the moment.
Steph Terry from Tasmanian Berries, thanks so much for coming on the Country Hour today.
Thanks for having me.
It's 29 past 12, which means we've got time to squeeze in just one more guest before the news. And we are in Elizabethtown, broadcasting to you today from Ashgrove Cheese in the stunning Meander Valley Municipality. And joining us now is Deputy Mayor Steph Cameron. Steph, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. So great to be here.
Another Steph. Now, you're not only in local politics, you're a farmer as well. Describe the farm for me.
So my husband and I purchased his family property about 5 years ago, and we farm, well, it's 250 acres of our own, and we lease another 250 acres. I say it's my husband and I, but it's actually probably our kids. We're probably just there to open the gates for them. They seem to be the ones really keen on it, which is really, it's really great.
How old are they?
Six and nearly 10.
So well old enough to be running a farm, obviously.
Well, we do joke. Yeah, I do think they know a little bit more about it than me, but yeah, it's really nice to see.
Now, how's the season looking at the moment?
Yeah, it's been, look, if this, a bit more of this sunshine could happen and maybe a little bit less wind, I think things would be looking up. But it, we delayed our lambing this year to try and get to a bit better weather. Didn't work out so well. We actually were lambing right in the middle of all those terrible rains and storms. So it was a bit horrific. But look, if it warms up, if it ever warms up, things will be looking okay.
And you'll be able to put the Christmas tree up, I believe. The weather's holding up the decorations.
Yes. Yeah, my daughter's greatest disappointment is that I don't have a Christmas tree yet, because where we are in Chudley, I'm still lighting the fire. So there's no room for the tree, which is a little bit disappointing for her.
Devastating news. Now, how important is agriculture to this region?
Well, we talk about Meander Valley being the green heart of Tasmania, and it really is. And you think about all of the different types of agriculture. You know, we've got ash grove here and so much dairy. We've got intensive cropping. We've, you know, fat lambs, cattle. We have everything. We also have great horticulture. And, you know, you just had Steph Terry on before from Tasmanian Berries. And it's huge employees in our area.
That's something to note, I guess, that's changed over the years. There's Ashgrove, you've got Christmas Hills Raspberries, you've got the ice cream place, so many of these huge businesses that have kind of mixed tourism in with agriculture.
Well, also very proud of Deloraine winning the silver at the small tourism town category in Canberra a few months ago. So, yes, agritourism is really huge in our area, and, you know, from a council perspective, we're really proud of it and encourage anyone, come along. You know, how could you not want to be here and see some of the things that these guys are doing here at Ashgrove?
Now, there is plenty more to talk about, but we are running out of time, so we better go to news headlines with Rachel Fisher.
Good afternoon. In ABC News, debate on the order to approve the Macquarie Point Stadium for Hobart's waterfront is continuing in Tasmania's Legislative Council. It continues as Tasmanian Premier Jeremy Rockliffe says he's confident the project can comply with a new cap on public expenditure. The state government has promised to cap public funding for the stadium at $875 million. That means that additional funding would need to come from other places if the stadium exceeds its current $1.13 billion price tag or change the design to lower the cost. A Tasmanian greyhound advocate says progress to end greyhound racing in the state is welcome. The state government is committed to phasing out the racing code by 2029. Legislation is scheduled to be debated in the lower house of parliament late today. From January, the breeding and importing of greyhounds for racing without the written consent of Tas Racing will be prohibited. And Gold Coast beaches battered by tropical cyclone Alfred have reopened after 8 months of restoration work. The local council has spent about $35 million to restore eroded beaches after the wild weather in March. And there'll be more news at one.
From city lights to mountain heights, the ABC Tasmania weather calendar for 2026. Available at selected retailers, the ABC Hobart Centre, and online at abc.net.au/Hobart. From 936 ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania on the ABC Listen app, the Tasmanian Country Hour with Meg Ferguson and Larissa Smith.
It is so great to have your company this Thursday. We are broadcasting live from Ashgrove at Elizabethtown on the Bass Highway, halfway between Launceston and Devonport for the Country Hour. And
that's
on the text line, Frederico says Elizabethtown was named after Governor Lachlan Macquarie's wife.
There you go.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't have any way of fact-checking that right now, but I believe him. Absolutely. Thank you. Thank you to our amazing
now,
listeners.
Now, you've got some cheese in front of you and
I
some cheesemakers.
I do. We are meeting yet another member of the ever-growing Bennett family, Richard. Thank you. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Meg, and happy birthday to the Country Hour.
Thank you. I'll take credit for it, even though I've come in at the very last second, honestly. Richard, you have been not only part of this business here, Ashgrove, but you've been a member of the TFS for many years.
Yeah, that's correct. I've been here at Ashgrove since I was, probably started making cheese when I was about 13. when we first built the cheese factory, and following Dad's 25 years in the TFS, I've been in the TFS for many, many years, and been brigade chief here at Elizabethtown for years. Well, now second officer though. So
one of the, I guess, iconic buildings left in Elizabethtown is the fire brigade building there.
Yeah, it sure was. When I was growing up, though, the fire brigade was actually on Mum and Dad's farm. So the fire truck used to be down beside the barn.
Now, you've brought someone along with us. Would you mind introducing us?
Yeah, sure. We've got our production manager, Shane Johns, here. So Shane's been with Ashgrove for many years now, too many for me to remember. But he's been here long enough that he was making cheese with me in the cheese room, which I don't get to do very often these days, and even Shane doesn't get to do that much. But, so Shane's been an integral part of our operation for many years.
Welcome to the Country Hour, Shane.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
You've just literally stepped off the production line, I think.
Yes, I've been out there making cheese today, so ready for our Christmas rush. So, been busy from about 6 o'clock this morning. So,
is it hot in there? There's lots of moisture on the windows.
Absolutely. Very hot in there, and we go through several changes to close the day because it is very humid and hot, hard work in there. So, yeah.
Now, how long have you been making cheese, Shane?
Well, I think I started my journey here about 20 years ago. I used to go to school with Richard many years ago and knocked on the door here one day and thought I'd be here for a week, and 20 years later, here I am. So,
and you've actually brought along some cheeses in front of us today. What part do you play in these, and can you sort of describe them for our radio audience?
Yeah, so we've got a variety of cheeses in front of us. We've got probably our signature cheese, which is our vintage cheddar. So where we get our advantage there, it's this cheese started its journey about 3 years ago on the farm as fresh milk, and 3 years later it's matured into a beautiful vintage cheddar. So that's probably our cornerstone, is our vintage cheddar. In front of us here, we're also well known for our wasabi cheese, so that's been a bit of a hit at around Australia, and people ask for that regularly around festivals and stuff where we attend. We also have our Mount Rowland bush pepper, so that's a Lancashire cheese infused with our native Tasmania pepper berries, so a bit of a Tasmania feel there. And last but not least, we've got a new cheese here, which is our signature blue. So this is something we've been working on, what would you say, Richard, 12 months ago we started this project?
Yeah, probably 12 to 18 months.
And it's just starting to come to fruition now, and we're getting some really positive feedback out in the market. So I'm really happy with the way it's turned out. So
Now, we better chop a slice of something. Larissa tells me I'm pregnant, so I can't eat the really fancy blue one, unfortunately. But let's try a little bit of this one here. Yeah, let's do that. And while we do that, Shane, what does it take to get a cheese to market?
Well, I guess it starts with good grass, then good milk, and then skilled cheesemakers. So we do lots of training here and train our cheesemakers, and Richard's given us great guidance over the years. And I guess it's just hard work and dedication, but also good milk. So
And a lot of interesting MPD meetings that have quite a few different discussions going on in them. So
Do you ever make one and just go, no, that's out, that's disgusting?
I think everyone has failures. I take my grandmother, she's a very good sponge cake maker, but occasionally she has a fail, and she admits that, so I'm happy enough to admit failure too. So but generally pretty good cheese.
Now, this one might be one for you, Richard. You are competing, this is a small to medium business on the dairy scale, really. You're competing against multinationals, particularly on the supermarket shelves. How do you stay competitive in such a business climate?
Yeah, great question. We kind of operate in a weird space for the Australian dairy industry, and a little bit bigger than farmhouse, and nowhere near the scale that the multinationals have. So it's really important for us to differentiate our products, to value add, and to have that premium space, and not try and compete with being, a commodity-based product. So that's always been an ethos that we have. And it, you know, to this date, we've managed to find our niche space. So,
Now, quickly to finish, we heard from the senior Bennett generation before a little bit about history. What's the future of Ashgrove? Where are you heading?
The future of Ashgrove, great question. So our milk has become a huge part of what we do and supporting into the Tasmanian industry, and we'll really continue to focus on that. We're also looking at different opportunities on the mainland in Australia, and we're exporting a little bit as well. So we'll continue to innovate and bring in new dairy products, and hopefully, you know, Tassie will get behind us. So.
Richard, Shane, thank you for joining us. Thank you for the cheese. We'll wait to see what happens in the next chapter of Ashgrove. Thank you.
Thanks, mate.
Well, this region has a rich dairying history. Mark Griffin is a fifth-generation dairy farmer at Multima, not far from here in Elizabethtown, and is the chair of the Milk Suppliers Committee with Cadbury. Mark, how long has your family been in this district?
Our family has been farming in this district for 180 years. Our first ancestors came out from Ireland in 1845 and were mixed enterprise farmers to begin with, doing some cropping and in the sheep industry and dairy at, a much, much smaller scale than the current climate.
So what do you put down to the family farm's longevity and its success?
Oh, I think a great deal of passion for what we do in our day-to-day and generally believing in being able to be better and better every day at what we do, knowing each other's strengths within the business and being part of an industry that we genuinely believe is making a major impact on a local and a global scale.
So investments in the last few years, you've got quite a big herd, around 900 head of cattle.
Yes, that's correct. So we're milking 950 cows twice a day, 10 months a year, supplying Cadbury 5.5 million litres of milk. And reinvesting quite heavily into our business with various infrastructure in water and underpasses and lots of different areas to basically ensure sustainability and profitability into the future and enable our business to be globally competitive and ensure that we can produce a globally elite product from year to year.
You've been supplying to Cadbury for the last 6 years now. Would you say Cadbury's demand for milk from its Tassie suppliers has dropped off in this last season?
Yeah, there's been some consolidation there due to cocoa prices tripling 12 months ago. So there's been definitely some consolidation there from Cadbury with their output of supply. But they're looking to recover from that big cocoa jump in the last 12 months. And yeah, in the next 12 months, there's some really strong signals there that they'll recover with their chocolate supply. And that's... yeah, provides great confidence for their 48 Tasmanian dairy suppliers.
So how has chocolate production dropped off? What sort of tonnes are we talking about?
So annually, Cadbury and Hobart produce 61,000 tonnes of chocolate a year, and they've pulled that back to 53 for this year. So that's what the drop-off.
And it's a challenging space because everyone is competing for that cacao that is in short supply, particularly with all these seasonal events affecting production.
Yeah, correct. Absolutely, 100%. Yeah, Cadbury are one of many chocolate companies in that space competing on that same price. So it's certainly, yeah, competitive for them, but suppliers understand the hurt they've been in, and I think the consumers can see that on the supermarket shelves with the prices chocolates had to go to. But I suppose, yeah, on the back of COVID, yeah, a few years ago, people searched for more chocolate and perhaps some...
as a comfort food.
Yeah, as some more comfort food, and it was... yeah, Cadbury's been voted for the fifth year in a row as the most trusted food brand on the shelf, so I think that's showing that consumers, yeah, hold Cadbury, yeah, to a very high standard and high reputation out on, yeah, in the market.
They trust what they're eating is chocolate.
Absolutely. No, I think that Tasmanian piece of sourcing their milk locally from Tasmanian family farms, from a factory that's been here for over 100 years, and counts for a lot.
But do you think that because of this pricing challenge that chocolate will really now be seen as a luxury item, whether you're buying it to sit on the table or you're buying it to bake with, it's not something that you would put in your trolley every week?
Yeah, I think definitely. I think, yeah, everybody's acutely aware and appreciates the cost of living challenges in the current climate we're in, and I think people definitely on volumes of product they're choosing to purchase, and the particular products they're choosing to purchase from their supermarket, the scrutiny's certainly on, and the pressure's on for Cadbury to be able to make that purchase achievable to the average consumer.
What do you enjoy most about living in this district, in the Meander Valley, in this part of the world?
Well, being lucky enough to travel to multiple different areas of the world, and it's funny, you come home after being in some of the most picturesque parts of the world and you look around the central north of Tasmania and you pinch yourself and you say, we're really lucky to live in this part of the world. It's one of the most scenic parts of the world. It's a slower paced life. There's fantastic people. Our access to resources is fantastic. We've got a nice optimum climate, great for the animals, great for producing milk at a globally competitive price, and yeah, I'm greatly appreciative of what the Meander Valley's given to our dairy industry and what it's given to me as a young person growing up, and I can't wait to share that with lots of other people in the next 20 to 30 years. And I think this, we're very, very lucky in this district to have access to lots of resources, and that's sector-wide, not just in the ag industry.
Mark Griffin, appreciate your insights on the program.
Thanks very much.
We're going to be talking to another person who's decided to call this area home from the UK in just a tick.
Talent Shield from Evenings with the ABC Giving Tree. A donation of $20 can help to feed someone a special Christmas lunch.
Text Giving Tree to 0438 922 936. We'll reply with a link for you to give.
Coast to Coast. This is Larissa Smith and Meg Ferguson and The Country Hour on 936 ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Great to have your company this afternoon. We're not too far away from 1 o'clock news. Yeah. You don't necessarily need to have ties to the land to have a career in the dairy industry. Our next guest is proof of that. Daniela Ashworth moved to Juniper Lea at Dairy Plains 3 years ago from the UK. How did you wind up there?
Well, I needed some farm work for my visa. So for the working holiday visa, you have to do some farm work to stay another year. So I put a post up on Facebook on some backpacking groups, and they responded to my post and offered me an opportunity to come down and see if I wanted to join them for calving season. So did calving season and ended up really enjoying it, and then did a bit of travelling around Australia and came back for another season, and I haven't left since, so still here 3 years later.
Now, your background is as a physio.
So I was working as a physio in the UK during COVID in the hospitals, and just needed a break, so I decided to go traveling, and ended up in Australia after 6 months in Central America, and started with the farm work, and really enjoyed it, and that's how I've ended up here.
Had you ever worked with animals before?
No agricultural background, and no one in my family in the UK has any agricultural background, so it just needed to give it a go for my visa, and ended up loving it, so it's worked out well.
So just explain what you do day to day on the farm.
So we milk 1,070 cows, and we're milking them twice a day, so kind of the role within everyone is to get the cows milked and calf rearing and pasture management, and just keeping an eye on the cow health. And since I've been here, I've stepped up into the 2IC role, so I'm gaining a bit more experience in kind of how the business runs and the financial side of things as well, So yeah, just a bit of everything really.
What time does your day start?
Oh, it varies. Some days it can be just after 3 a.m. Our first milking starts at 4 a.m. So, and other times it starts between 7 and 8. So, yeah, you get used to the early morning. So
I was going to say, does your body ever get used to adjusting to that 3 o'clock?
Yeah, it does. And I think most of our team would say we enjoy the earlier mornings because you still get the rest of the day to do everything else you want to do. So it works out well.
So what do you enjoy most about being involved in the dairy industry?
I just love being outdoors now, especially in Meander Valley. It's so scenic, and with the dairy industry, there's different seasons within the season. So you have calving season and mating and silage and dry off. So there's always something that you're looking forward to next, and it's not the same every day. And you know, some days the cows keep you on your toes, and yeah, so every day is different, and you're not doing the same thing all the time.
And I suppose when you moved to the property, you never envisaged that you'd become the Dairy Employee of the Year, picking up that award.
No, definitely not, no. Yeah, when we first came, it was just, you know, helping to rear the calves and do some milking, and yeah, wouldn't have ever thought that I'd be end up in this position, so but it's worked well.
Terrific. Well, great to hear some positive stories happening in this area. Daniela Ashworth from Juniper Lee at Dairy Plains. Thanks for coming on the Country Hour.
Thank you.
All right, I better find my next guest. Larissa, I think he's talking to Maureen Bennett over there. Come and take a seat. Come and take a seat. We are broadcasting to you from Elizabethtown, from Ashgrove Cheese. Now, this area is home to some stunning historic properties, and there's one Georgian period home that you can catch a glimpse of from the Bass Highway near Elizabethtown, and that's Forest Hall. Now, Stu and Emma Burgess became custodians of the historic manor in 2023. Stu, welcome to the Country Hour.
Thank you very much, Meg.
How did that come about? I believe there was some trickery involved.
Definitely a bit of sly work from myself. We were coming over. We've been on and off in Tasmania, mostly in the south over the last 30-odd years, moved to Hobart originally. But we were based in Sydney at the time. And I've been looking for a farm. I'm an ex-farmer from South Coast, New South Wales. So 30-odd years later, constantly on the lookout, found this one, saw that it was for sale for a number of months. And then I knew we were coming across, get off the ferry, and took a little quiet detour. It's not a detour as such, but then pulled up outside for sale sign and made sure that everyone had a good look at the property. And they all went, oh, gosh, it looks lovely. So that was it. And we then, within a few days, had a look. Caught up with the agent, Mark Raniker, and off we went. And so, yeah, 6 months later, owners.
What a coincidence. It was for sale.
Yeah. Who knew?
Now, you have a bit of a connection to Tasmania. You did say you were from the south coast of New South Wales, Gerringong, I believe.
Correct, that's right. Gerringong and Jamboree for both of us. So
beautiful spot, beautiful part of the world. But you have a connection to Tasmania.
Well and truly. Look, my mother-in-law and all my wife's uncles and aunties are all based out of the south of Tassie. Over a period of about 20 years, they moved here quite a while ago now. And so we moved here back probably about 93, 94. Started working for UTAS down there under Prof. Rob Clark, which is great. Had a number of years in that, and then I've been in other roles over the years. So, yeah.
Now, for context for our listeners out there, a school group has just walked in, a lot of kids, very busy here. Now, can you describe the property for us, Stu?
Look, it was originally, and I've just heard from Maureen Bennett and got a bit of an update, which you always do, nearly
every local historian
has something about it, but look, it was around the mid-1800s, 1845, if you read Susan Irvin's book from a few years ago, who really transformed the most recent iteration of Forest Hall. But look, its history is around that mid-1800s. William and Sarah Bonnelly came out from Scotland. He was a blacksmith, and I heard earlier on the radio they talked about the blacksmith's cottage, and it's still there. And so there's still some of the blacksmith equipment, etc.
Have you tried any?
No, not going to happen.
Not so much your gene?
No, not my thing. I'm a horticulturist, so that was my passion and love for the whole place. But yeah, so it's had that early mid-1800s, and then almost went to a little rack and ruin later on, 300-acre parcel. But Susan Irvin and Bill came around the mid-90s And they've really transformed it. And she was a rose, crazy rose aficionado, wrote two books about Forest Hall, and plus many others, etc. And so we've kind of picked it up after the most recent owners, and just, yeah, enjoying it. We're only custodians. It's one of those passions and love, but we'll be handing it on to someone at some point.
Now, speaking of those roses, Susan was quite famous for her roses, obviously, and you're a horticulturalist. It must just be paradise for you.
It is, and the crazy thing is we're nearly 2 years in and I can still walk around there, and I just walk around every time I catch up and I'll find little tags and old things that were growing previously, but there'll be areas of the garden that we're still working on, and suddenly you'll find a new rhododendron or a new rose or something. That, and it's just incredible. The, like, nearly 300 odd varieties. I've been trying to kind of marry up some of her history from her designs and books with the actual what's still there now, and there's probably a good 30 or 40 more. So it's, yeah, around that 350 odd varieties of different roses, a lot of old roses. So I've joined the Rose History, Australian Rose History Society, which is based out of the south, and so just to, I'm a horticulturist, but not by any sense a rose guru, but learning lots every day.
And it must be challenging in the sense that she created a masterpiece. Is it putting your own stamp on there? It would be like painting over.
Yeah, there's an element of that. I think the what we're seeing is that we're putting a bit of framework around it, and so that's the little hedges and the age of the property. You've got beautiful old oak trees and some of the old pines, etc., that are starting to kind of see their last legs. So it's that element of bit of a transition and making sure whatever is there for another 200 odd years. So,
and as custodians, that must be quite a both a privilege but a burden on you, that you've got to make sure this place is around for the next people.
Yeah, look, it's a funny thing. We only see ourselves as custodians. You can't. It's one of those properties that you don't see yourself as an owner. And so, yeah, there is an element of you trying every rose. I've had a gardener that I've had working with me part-time, and he's moved to Brisbane recently. But basically with the roses, I said to him, do not, even if it looks dead, just do not throw it out. And okay. So there's that element where you do actually feel responsible even for some of the older things that you find. And the house, looking after it, making sure it's kind of there to stay, and the outbuildings, because they're incredible just in and of themselves. So
much history. We'll have to arrange a visit at some point. Larissa, Stu, thank you for joining us today.
It's a pleasure. Thanks, Meg.
Larry, that brings us to nearly the end of the Country Hour, broadcasting live from Ashgrove Cheese. It's been a good hour. I'm really hot in here.
Yeah, we'll venture outside. I think we're not used to having the heat, right?
True. But I mean, it's very much needed, as we heard from the berry growers. We need a bit of sun. We've had the rain. We need the wind to calm down so we can get on with the summer.
And we've appreciated all the lovely text messages that have come through across the week as we celebrate our 80th. Tony Briscoe back in the big chair tomorrow.